If you turn over your order of service to look at the back cover, we have listed our seven principles and our six sources. Our first principle is the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And I'd like us to reflect a little this morning about the significance of that statement, as well as the significance of having that be our starting point, our first principle. For example, the opening lines of the Roman Catholic Church's catechism affirms that the dignity of man rests above all on the fact that he is in communion with God. And while you can hold that position and be fully within the big tent of Unitarian Universalism, our first principle makes a much more radical claim, that the inherent worth and dignity of every person, period, irrespective of anything else or any other belief. And because we can become so accustomed to claims like that, it's right there on the back of your order of service every week, right? We can sometimes take it for granted. It has to be true. Everyone must believe it. It's right there. It's our first principle. But I think we should be careful about taking this starting point for granted, because historically, it has certainly not been the case that always and everywhere the inherent worth and dignity of every person has been respected. In many cases, it's been just the opposite. In 1961, when the American Unitarian Association and the Universalist Church of America consolidated to form what we now know today as the Unitarian Universalist Association, we originally had six principles that were similar, but were in a different order than the ones we know today. At that point, the dignity one was actually three instead of one. These principles were revised in 1985 to make them significantly more gender inclusive, among other things. And in 1961, when we affirmed in that time's language the supreme worth of every human personality and the dignity of man, presumably a major influence on that choice that I think has become maybe masked with time is the 1948 United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That when you see that first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, looming large behind it is that UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights that I think we can forget sometimes. The very first line of that UN preamble recognizes that the inherent dignity and the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. Likewise, following the preamble, the very first sentence of Article 1 of that UN Declaration says, "All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and in rights." The writing and passage of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was a direct result of the horrors of what we did to one another, the inhumane and undignified things that we did in World War I that, of course, ended in 1945, and then they spent 2 years working on the Declaration of Human Rights, and it was finally passed in 1948. For me, it's an incredibly powerful, significant, and hopeful to be part of a religious movement who's explicitly chosen to weave into our first principle the starting point of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The recognition and value of human dignity is also foundational for the Geneva Convention, which passed the very next year after the Declaration of Human Rights in 1949, and reminds us that all human beings and every person, that really means everybody, even prisoners of war. The Geneva Convention prohibits both cruel treatment and torture, as well as outrages upon personal dignity, in particular, humiliating and degrading treatment. Such as infamously in recent memory, the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. This background is one reason that human rights organizations, such as our own UU Service Committee, have spoken out quite loudly about and against torture, including when torture is veiled behind Orwellian doublespeak and called enhanced interrogation techniques. When we violate one another's dignity, what we're risking is devolving into a world of violence, cruelty, and might makes right. As Harvard professor Michael Rosen said in his short but important 2012 book, Dignity, Its History and Meaning, it's quite good and easy to read if you're interested. He wrote that the barriers that separate modern liberal democracies from barbarism and atrocities that characterized many parts of the 20th century and are very much still with us in the 21st century, that line between modern liberal democracy and barbarism and atrocity, it is very, very thin and very fragile. Rosen also fascinatingly traces the ways that what is seen to follow from granting the importance of human dignity is very different depending on who you talk to. For example, many conservative theologians argue that human dignity mandates that from conception through death, one must not violate human life, that it must not be taken artificially. At the same time, internationally known organizations like Dignitas, it's a Swiss organization, argues that human dignity requires that humans have the freedom to choose death with dignity, such as physician-assisted death in the right circumstances. Similarly, many conservative theologians argue that human dignity does not conflict with their opposition to same-sex relationships. Other organizations, such as Dignity USA, say that the only way to respect the dignity of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender persons is to allow same-sex relationships as fully legitimate at all levels of our world. Or there's a case of a student who was expelled from a university for wearing a very short dress. The school characterized this as a letter to her saying, "You have been expelled for a flagrant lack of respect for academic dignity." She, in turn, countersued them for trampling her dignity. Rosen summarizes these two sides as in these ends of the spectrum as, for many religious conservatives, human dignity gives life a value that may properly override the choices made by individuals living it. On the other hand, for many liberals in the U.S. in particular, dignity is identified with autonomy and in the sense of an individual's right to choose for themselves how they will live and even how they will die. For those here a few weeks ago, you may rightly be hearing echoes of the sermon I preached in the wake of the election about the differences of Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine and how those are paradigmatic examples of our modern left and right. But perhaps the most important point that's behind both of these sides of the coin about dignity is that we as a species, however you come down on dignity, are increasingly choosing to universalize dignity. And that's something that we shouldn't take for granted. Because human beings have certainly not seen universalizing dignity as inevitable choice then or now. Historically, dignity has most often been the privilege of the aristocratic few. So who had dignity? The queen had dignity, right? The aristocratic few had dignity, not the common people. So it's really it is quite a radical thing to say the inherent worth and dignity of every person. In that spirit, allow me to bring one more book into the conversation. Dr. Donna Hicks's book with Yale University Press, Dignity, Its Essential Role in Resolving Conflicts. Dr. Hicks has been working for decades with international conflict resolution, and the foreword to her book is written by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who knows a few things about conflict resolution himself. She's seen many global conflicts begin to be transformed when past indignities were finally named aloud, and when the two parties finally started to realize and recognize again the worth and dignity of the person across the table, and began to see in that those people's eyes, the other side, they began to see that person suddenly recognizing their worth and dignity as well, and it makes all the difference in conflict resolution. No longer seeing the other as subhuman, but seeing that person as having inherent worth and dignity. She writes that her essential message is simple. Demonstrate the care and attention for yourself and others that anything of value deserves. Don't miss an opportunity to exert whatever power you have, whatever sphere of influence you have. Don't miss an opportunity to remind others of who they are. Invaluable, priceless, and irreplaceable. Each one of us is irreplaceable. There's not going to be another one. Invaluable, priceless. And remind yourself, too, she writes. Indeed, one of the most powerful lines in her book is a testimony from a Latin American political official who said, regarding the Hicks's model of dignity and how it had helped these Latin American countries resolve their differences, he said, "Not only did you help the relationships in this room, I think you just saved my marriage." From the opposite angle, what a lot of therapists will tell you and what a lot of studies have shown is that maybe the number one sign that a marriage is headed for the rocks is when the primary kind of view that the others that they have toward each other is one of contempt. sort of the opposite of dignity, that if you see these couples treating each other with contempt, it's a very, very bad sign. And one of the only hopes for that is restoring this view of the inherent worth and dignity of the other. Along these lines, I should pause here and say that the reason I chose to preach on the topic of dignity is in honor of a former president of this congregation, Carl Crum, who died a little more than a month ago. Carl's service as president of our Board of Trustees was cut short in its first year by his cancer diagnosis. And when I spoke with Carl about his vision for this congregation that really should have been lived out, at least over 2 years or more, the major theme he was interested in was our first principle, was indignity. And the two books I've drawn on for this sermon by Rosen and Hicks are the two that he said inspired him to think that. They're the two books he gave me as he was dying. Part of Carl's legacy for us is a challenge to live more fully into our first principle, what Donna Hicks calls creating a culture of dignity, to be intentional about creating a culture of dignity here and in the other communities where we're involved, in which everyone would be aware of just how easy it is to inflict painful wounds on another's dignity. And accordingly, to learn how to extend dignity to one another and create an environment in which people look forward to being here because they're seen as invaluable, as priceless, as irreplaceable. The desire to create a culture of dignity is related to why Carl spent so much time, along with a number of other members of this congregation, volunteering with the Alternatives to Violence Project, which works with prison inmates, and is part of the Community Correctional Services Committee, which, in a happy synchronicity, is our split plate offering. I didn't plan that, but that's a happy coincidence. I'll be seeing more about that AVP perspective in a forthcoming sermon in December on nonviolent communication, but I'll say just one piece for now. Related to the need to be intentional about creating a culture of dignity, consider just one study of 25 inmates who had been imprisoned for murder. When asked why they felt compelled to kill, the majority said, "Because I felt disrespected." Talk about the need for a culture of dignity. Conversely, Nelson Mandela is one of the most stunning examples of maintaining a culture of dignity and one's own dignity in some of the worst circumstances. After being wrongfully imprisoned for more than 27 years by the apartheid government of South Africa, Mandela said a day after his release in 1990, "I knew that people expected me to harbor anger toward whites, but I had none. In prison, my anger toward whites decreased, but my hatred for the system grew. I wanted South Africa to see that I loved my enemies even while I hated the system that had turned us against one another. Whites are fellow South Africans, and we want them to feel safe and know that we appreciate the contribution they have made to the development of this country." I mean, what a stunning affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of someone who has done you incredibly wrong. Part of what inspired this view in Mandela and what helped him continue to claim and affirm his inherent worth and dignity through those 27 years, as many of you know, is the poem Invictus. It goes like this. "Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I think whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." That they wouldn't let them, he wouldn't let them take his dignity away. What then might it look like in much more everyday circumstances to create a culture of dignity? One crucial piece of advice that Hicks gives is don't take the bait. If you want to contribute to creating a culture of dignity, don't take the bait. Don't let the bad behavior of others determine your own. Restraint, she writes, is the better part of dignity. Don't justify getting even. Ray talked with us about the stories we tell. Don't tell that story. Don't justify getting even. Do not do unto others as they do unto you, if it will just cause more harm in this world. But when conflicts inevitably happen, the following adapts a framework that she recommends for reconciliation and a process that still honors each person's dignity. First, she writes, both parties must agree that sitting down together is worth their time and attention. Isn't it much more common to withdraw from those we have a conflict with and refuse to talk to them? But that's not to respect their inherent worth and dignity. To respect their inherent worth and dignity is to take the time to sit down with them face to face and to restore a right relationship. Second, listen without interrupting or challenging the other's story. Listen to seek understanding. Isn't it much more common for us to listen to our adversaries only to seek to one-up them or to prepare our attack? But that's not to respect their inherent worth and dignity. Third, acknowledge and recognize what the other has been through. Because isn't it much more common to state without expression, totally affectless, to the person we have injured in the heart of a conflict and feel defensive and justified and just to sit there stony-faced? Fourth, acknowledge and honor each other's integrity and seek to restore a mutual bond of trust. And so in the days and weeks to come, I invite you to experiment with what it feels like with all the different people you encounter in your life. What I want you to do is experiment with hearing whispering in your ear when you're sitting across from people, encountering random people, inherent worth and dignity. To claim that for yourself and to claim that and honor that in the other person. Inherent worth and dignity. I want that to be whispering in your ear in the coming weeks. Experiment with that. And to close with a blessing from Desmond Tutu, which I believe is also the legacy and challenge that Karl Crum would have left to us and did leave us. May we become agents of dignity. May we become agents of dignity in this world. Agents of dignity who seek to name and proclaim, to accept in yourself, to discover and encourage in others their inherent worth and dignity. If we do that, if we start from that place, peace may just be possible.